Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 173, Managing Misery with A.A. Shantideva and the Heart Sutra.
What is interesting is this sutra is actually taught by Avalokiteshvara. And Avalokiteshvara is the god bodhisattva, divine bodhisattva, who cares about the universe. Avalokita means who looks with, he looks on with care. And it's actually a critique of a Hindu Vedic idea of Mahaeshvara, the great god, the creator, you know, kind of like the all-powerful, you know. So this is the Avalokita, the god who cares. You know, it's like a he is a Buddha, actually, but he manifests as a bodhisattva, and he sometimes manifests as female. He's Kuan Yin in China, or Kanon in Japan. Doesn't who can it mean, be either male or female.
Doesn't it mean she who hears what? She who hears our cries, isn't that...
I'm sorry?
She who hears our cries, isn't that one of the other...
Well, that's a sort of version of the Chinese thing. That's instead of Ishvara, it's Swara, which can be sound. Mm. So there's a lot of, you know... The Chinese stopped really getting much transmission from India around 6th, 7th century. So then they had a certain idea about it. But they didn't miss on Tara, you know, the female Avalokiteshvara and so on. They don't have Tara. So therefore they have Avalokiteshvara. It's Kuan Yin, Kuan Shi Yin, which means who sees the and sees the sounds of beings crying, of which has the same idea of crying, you know, suffering, you know. Sees the sound of their crying, and therefore is the universal compassion of all Buddhas, the idea, incarnation of compassion of all Buddhas. So, in other words, this sutra is taught by Avalokiteshvara rather than by the Buddha. The Buddha just goes into a samadhi, which in his case is more of like a sort of creates a spacious vibe that then affects everyone in his field. Which is the called the illumination of the profound. That's the clear light of the void, that means. And then Avalokiteshvara has an epiphany where he sees his material and mental processes. He realizes their utter relativity, that is, that they are free of any kind of intrinsic reality of anything that would not relate to anything else. And then again, within that field, Shariputra, who is the dualistic Theravada, Hinayana, or you know, dualistic Buddhist saint and Buddha's foremost disciple in that field, he asked Avalokiteshvara, he's inspired to ask, well, how do you do this transcendence of wisdom thing? And then, and he says, noble son, notice he's a little chauvinist. And then Avalokiteshvara says, noble son or noble daughter. Makes a big point of that. And then they go on, and tomorrow I might do some more about the sort of main meat paragraph, which is this next big long one. You know, realize the five, and especially the big statement here is voidness is matter, matter is voidness. Meaning that, you know, this hard tabletop and my knuckle both are voidness, not just the atoms inside it. Because otherwise we think that, well, matter is some hard thing, not void, you know. Because sort of with matter is the ultimate thing that we think is non-void, you know. But here it is void. And my knuckle can hit the tabletop, because both are empty of being an intrinsically real knuckle and an intrinsically real tabletop. They're just a relative tabletop and a relative knuckle, so therefore I can knock on them, because they're empty. Therefore they can function. Emptiness enables the function. The negation of anything fixed and absolute in any relative thing makes it relationally functional, if you follow. So the ah, that's the negation, and the ah that creates is same. wisdom and compassion are same. And once you have the idea of the absolute is this relative, then what is the absolute concern is the quality of the relative, because there's no escape from it. And therefore, any aspect or being in the relative is suffering, even if they're doing so by mistake. That is your absolute concern. So then that's where the wisdom becomes compassion. Compassion meaning the intolerability of anyone's suffering, which itself, again, the intolerability of their suffering only can arise from a bliss of the wise being, the bliss of the release of wisdom, where it sees that other beings' actual state is the state of bliss. That's what holds them together, is the strong force in all of their cells and everything is their bliss. And then they don't enjoy it because they think they're deprived of something. They're having separation anxiety. So that's where wisdom becomes compassion. So that thing, that's why those gurus, those holy beings, those different even mystical traditions that teach that, you know, salvation ultimate is leaving town. Oh yeah, I went off to big nirvana somewhere else. They thereby cut off compassion. If you can leave and go somewhere, and then you say, well, at least I'm not around hurting anybody, not making a problem, I'm not using up the air because I'm gone. But it's actually psychosis. The idea that you're going to be blissful somewhere apart from everywhere, and that'll be everything. It's just you and all of, I call it the cheap oneness. It's the cheapo version of oneness. Oh, I realized emptiness. The whole world was just emptiness. And, well, I wasn't even there, so you don't, I'm not guilty. But it was my awareness was just this vast space of emptiness. And all these people, just an illusion, and they're suffering just an illusion, and mine was an illusion. Oh, gee, now I'm back just temporarily until my momentum of my embodiment kind of wears out, and then I clunk over, and then I'm gone. And I'm all alone, all one, nobody else is there, and really, I'm not really, so it's not like I'm enjoying it without you. But that's a that's ultimate isolated psychosis. And it's not absolute anyway, because a relative being entered it, therefore it has a doorway and a boundary, and therefore it's a relational state. So it's a delusion that it's an absolute. And it's an ultimate selfishness. And then, since nobody can stay there anyway, because there's a kind of state, like feels like a form of state. And then the person's back hanging out, and then they behave selfishly. And then they make cults, and they wreck Dharma centers, and they're a pain in the neck. Give me a few Rolls Royces. I'm enlightened. Give me a break. Give us all a break. Excuse me. Okay? So the expensive oneness is, okay, it all disappears in a certain mood, in a certain concentration, it seems to all disappear. But then, it's here. So then, the here-ness and the disappearness ultimately merge. So that just means it disappears as a bunch of isolated, relative, absolute things. And it's here as a totally interwoven relational thing. So there's nothing to do but make it better. And but somehow being aware that it's kind of, any kind of ultimacy about it disappearing gives a kind of blissful release feeling that kind of can overwhelm all the mistaken notion of misery somehow. I mean, that's all indescribable. So therefore, we just talk about it a lot, but none of what we say will capture it, actually. You can't capture the tolerance of extreme cognitive dissonance, you know, the embodiment of extreme cognitive dissonance, of relative, the absolute relativity. But the great analogy is the mirror. When you see a reflection in a mirror, it looks like there's another room over there and there's another person. We have our little Pekingese dog, the little cute one running around. He hasn't figured that out yet, and he finds a long mirror in my daughter's house, And he goes over there and he really woofs it up with that creature in there that really makes him mad. They really go for it. He hasn't quite figured out that it's himself. But so that's what it looks like to us. Then the disappearance is you realize there's nothing in there. There's no other thing. It's just a reflection of this. But then you see the reflection of this, and then you really, you know, you put on your face or shave or whatever it is you're doing in the mirror, or look in the rearview mirror in your car. You correct the left-right without another thought, the distortion. And you completely engage with it, but you know it's an illusion. It's just a mirror reflection. So that's the Buddha's way of dealing with us. He sees us as a reflection of the bliss void indivisible of reality. And therefore, he doesn't get caught up in our misperception that we're in misery. He acknowledges that we feel that with his first noble truth. But he's like the doctor who sees the health in the patient, sees the getting over it to himself or herself of the patient, and therefore is able to stay cool and sort of slowly allow the patient to discover that, help them discover that. Right? So that's the analogy that you do. So that's our sutra. And gate, see, gate means gone. You know, so gate, gone, paragate, very gone, super gone, parasamgate, super totally gone. Bodhi means awakeness or enlightenment. Swaha means all hail. So that's why gate. But the Spanish translation of my translation of that, they didn't consult me. So when I saw that, when they sent me a copy, it said, Puerta, puerta. Puerta grande, puerta muy grande. That's why I put the Y. So people don't think it's gate. I was very distressed. Puerta, puerta. Puerta grande, puerta muy grande. But it is puerta. It's a doorway into bliss void indivisible. Still. Okay, that's all. That's it for me tonight. Okay, let's go. Chris, Q&A. Or whatever. Or you want to do something?
No.
¿Cómo te llamas?
Carla.
What is your name?
Carla.
Ana?
Carla.
What?
Carla.
Oh, Carla. Oh, qué bueno. Carla. Sebastián, Noah. ¿Y cómo se llama el viejo?
The red hair, Dante.
¿Cómo?
Dante.
What?
Dante.
Dante Alighieri? Yeah. Oh my. Poor guy is going around carrying a big pen on him.
Ooh. It was the first
La
one.
La puerta. Okay. Yes, Carla.
My question is,
¿qué quieres saber?
The more I hear you, I understand. Would it be correct, going back to your example about the nose, would it be correct to understand that the nose doesn't exist in terms of being something separated from our body? So it's a construction, right? The idea of
right.
The nose. But yet we recognize the existence of the functionality of the nose as part of the body, right? So it's not that it's empty or nothing. It's empty of their own value as separate from the body, but it still exists, right?
Right.
So why don't you call it in terms of, instead of emptiness, wholeness, the whole idea?
The what?
Why don't you call it wholeness instead of emptiness?
Wholeness, why don't you?
Yeah, why don't you?
Because, principle.
Because
it was already taken. That word was
very
taken
good.
Already.
Very, muy buena pregunta. Very good question. Because the reason you would call it emptiness, to start with, is because when we see the nose, we, without realizing it, you know, like Plato, there's an ideal form of noseness that is instantiated in a particular nose for Plato. That's called the forms, you know. And every one of the metaphysicians in the Western thought and some kinds of Eastern thought, they feel there must be something in it that really makes it the referent of our concept nose. And because therefore when we suffer, we feel we really suffer. And therefore when we feel we're here, we feel we're really here. And therefore when we lose our temper, then this rage that says, I'm going to get them, you know, which would carry us right into death, actually, or killing. It's so powerful. You know, it's really there. You know, we can't resist it because it's so real, you see. It's really real. We exaggerate quality of knowing. So the emptiness is that what we discover, and we have to keep meditating, we have to keep analyzing, we have to keep vipassanaing and seeing through the real nose, the real ear, the real eye, the real this, the real that, the real emotion, the real anger, the real etc. And then we begin to realize it's relational. It gets more and more like where we can question it. So that's the balm, the medicine of our that helps us out of our entrapment in thinking it's really. Then when we're really old, then we're in such a misery. That nice nose we used to have, it all collapses down on the face. You know, if we drank a lot, it all turns red and it kind of old. It goes drooping down the face in the most horrible manner. We can rush to surgeons and have them put in a little pert little thing, you know, and then the rest of the face will flat, and they quickly pat that up. Then we end up looking like one of those things in the movie Brazil, like this. Because to us, that nice nose was the real nose, and this other thing is some kind of an infestation. It's a disease. It's a horror. It's horrible. We suffer. But when we relax, actually, about it, we relate to it, indeed, they even say then the nose gets more relaxed. The cells of the nose, the whole thing, doesn't collapse as badly. Sometimes you see these 99-year-old yogis, and they still have like a youthful-looking nose. Then they collapse. It actually, you know, because your face is, you know, personality, you know, persona in Latin means a mask. So then I think, you know, Bob, when I was 18, I was really cool. I had both eyes. I was like, I played the trolls and crescent. I used to dance on tables with Salamanca boots, drunk as a skunk. So that was the real thing, right? And then I can't bear it changing and, you know, losing this and that because it gets stuck. So that's why the emptiness is the liberating, it's the solvent, it's the lubrication of the functionality of the relative. And then it makes the relative the absolute concern, which means it makes compassion the most important thing. Love becomes everything. Compassion and love are the same. Love is the determination that the beloved be happy. Compassion is the intolerance of the beloved's suffering. So they're just two sides of the same coin. And that becomes everything because there's no getting away. It's like, shall I tell my subway thing?
Please.
Everyone, all the Vipassanites love my subway thing. New York subway, right? You guys are New Yorkers, a lot of you. Right? You get on the subway. How do you interact with other people on the subway? Zero interaction. You have your phone. Nowadays, you used to have a newspaper with you. If you were doomed because you forgot to bring the newspaper or the latest novel, you're doomed to read the commercials. You know, and learn how you can go to a school and learn how to get a free call in three languages. But now we have phones, so we can get on the read our Kindle or like check things, and then they're putting Wi-Fi down there to keep us in the hypnosis. You know? So you have no relation with the other people in the subway, and even so, you don't look at anybody, no eye contact. If you make eye contact, you get jumpy, and then you want to make sure they don't follow you out, and then you get on that station. They want to make sure you don't follow them out, and it's like minimal connection. Right? Mad scientist. Suddenly, subway car, James Bond fantasy, shunted onto a sideline, slam metal doors and things come down. You hear Henry Kissinger's voice saying, "This is natural security experiment. What is going to happen to you? You're never going to leave here. You're going to stay here forever. There is toilet there, and the food will be brought, but you cannot get out. And don't tell me you have a credit card. Will not do any good. You will be a victim of terrorism, national security experiment." I mean, I know it's a silly analogy, but then suddenly, what do you do with the other people in the subway car? You're stuck with them. They're stuck with you. Suddenly, well, who's the friend? Who's the? Somebody's freaking out. Everybody's concerned, right? No, nobody's not your family suddenly because you're locked in this space with them, right? So people might think they'll get out and it's fake and they'll freak out for a little while, but eventually you're there. So the Buddhist view of absolute relativity is it's endless. It's not just, there's no way. Nobody gets out of here a dead. You just die and you're all my exes, yes, I screwed them over in that final I got a harder lawyer than theirs, and I got everything, and they left nothing, and blah, blah, blah. No. Next lifetime, you fall in love with that ex again. And they have a better lawyer. And there's no escape from anybody. So then what? Everything, every tiny thing becomes of maximum infinite importance. That every relationship you want to optimize a little bit, it's a beautiful thing. Samadhi Raja Sutra, the king of Samadhi Sutra says, who understands cause and effect, causality, you know, karma, you know, action, function, interconnection. Whoever understands cause and effect, that person will understand emptiness. Whoever understands emptiness, they become mindful, alert, to the most minute details of everything. Isn't that nice? You would think from the way some of these enlightened people behave, that understanding emptiness, and you wouldn't give a damn about anything. Because it, just like materialists don't ultimately really give a damn. That's why they are overheating this planet. Because they think just I die and I'm out of here, like the French king. Après moi la déluge. Right? But if you're here forever with everyone, you cannot leave anybody out. You cannot leave anybody your enemy. You cannot be content with anybody's misery because it's going to come back to you. You won't dish out any misery. You're just going to be the node, the nexus of trying to just change every kind of thing into something. Sometimes it can only be a little tiny bit better. And the example I always like to use, Shantideva, the great Shantideva, he says, and this is sort of in the level of ethics and human interaction, he says, in all my lives, if anybody ever asks me for any directions, like where's the bathroom, you know, like where's the conference center, like where's Mitha, I will never point where to go to them with one finger like this. I will never do that. Because when you do that, you're like a boss, you know, they don't, you're like pulling some kind of superiority over them, you know. I'm going to go over there, you know. I know. No, I will take my whole hand like a host inviting an honored guest to go where they want to go. And I will invite them, the men's room, the bathroom is over there. And I will reflect that someday I will be able to invite them to their own nirvana. Someday I will invite them to freedom. And I will never just boss them like this. I consider that the most exquisite thing. That's a tiny detail, right? A little bit of body language self-awareness. You know. But it's infinite in its impact over an infinite set of consequences. Right? You get it? Like, and a final word. When I wrote this one book that I personally like called Infinite Life, my editor hated the title. And I wanted a picture of the Buddha Infinite Life, which is a particular name of a particular Buddha. Amitayo means infinite life. I wanted a picture of that Buddha on the cover. And they said, no, we're not going to have a Buddha on the cover. We're going to make this really popular. So we don't want a Buddha. And also, you don't want that infinite life. It sounds weird. And then they said, and then they argue with me, and then I discovered in the contract they get to pick the title, the publisher.
The cover.
But I kept fighting.
They get to pick the cover.
What?
The cover they get to pick.
Yeah, and the title.
And the title.
Ultimately. Oof. If you really go, mm-hmm. you know, push, come to shove. Mm-hmm. But they'll discuss it with you because they don't want you to not market it for
right.
them. You know? Anyway, so the final threat, the final sort of like argument they had was, oh, come on, Bob. You don't want to go around promising people infinite life, do you? And I said, no, of course not, I said. I want to go around threatening them with infinite life. Did you ever see that movie, Death Becomes Her, it's called, I think? About these people who couldn't die and then they wanted to? Because they were all twisted around by auto accidents and things. Remember that movie? Mm-mm. Goldie Hawn was in it, and all kinds of people. So the point is, if you're here, we're all here. Like right now, here we are, all of us together. We have the doc here, Dr. Who, Dr. Mark. And we have, he doesn't want to be Mark so much anymore. He likes to be Dr. Who. But you don't watch Dr. Who, I bet.
I don't know Dr. Who.
Oh, I know all these people. They don't watch TV.
You do, you know.
Dr. Who, I don't know if it's on Netflix, but it's so far out, some of the Doctor Who. Really, it is. And And now I lost track of what I said.
We're all here together at Menlo.
Oh, yeah, so we feel, then it's Sunday, you know, lunch, and then pack up your, you know, unpack your pillowcase and put it on the floor, and then you go and you're back on Highway 28 and Thruway and the whole thing. And then, okay, great, good luck. But we're going to be here, we're going to be back together forever, all of us, every single one life or another, somewhere or another. Next lifetime, you're going to be teaching this. And we're going to be trying to figure it out. You know, you're going to be the doctor. We're going to try to figure it out. So we'll never stop. So therefore, what is the optimal way to relate to each other? Everybody's in love with everybody else. Not meaning that somehow they're going to molest and bother each other. It means that everybody is going to care about the happiness of everybody else. And in a way, there'll be your own concern will be sort of less important to you because there's so many other people you're concerned with. And actually, although that's the wonderful paradox, that's the wonderful cognitive dissonance, the more you want everyone else to be happy, the more naturally you'll be happy. The more you want yourself to be, this is Shantideva's unmatched, and the Dalai Lama has that lineage, unmatched teaching. And the more you want yourself to be happy, what happens? You're dissatisfied with how far you've gotten. So by thinking about, well, what's in it for me? How good is this for me? How good was it? As you're puffing away there on the edge of the bed. Not that good. Could have been better. Buy a different drug, do something. Then you want something else, get a different partner, whatever. It's not that good. So by focusing on your own happiness, you're just always dissatisfied. Forgetting about your own happiness because you so much want everybody else to be, then, hey, you're kind of like, whoops, I got cheered up because I didn't notice. Then I notice, oh, no, what am I wasting my time? What happened? That Shantideva thing is really, it's just awesome, actually. And I think all the great, like, the great rabbis, like Jesus, he was just a great rabbi. You know, those people in Texas should have to figure that out one day. He was a rabbi. He wasn't even really quite white. There was a forensic guy in Western England, you know, who like helps find like murderers from skeletons, you know, and he builds up from the skull, you know, he builds up what they must have looked like. And Jesus looks like a Pakistani taxi driver. He does. The way he made it up, you know, Palestine that time, blah, blah, blah. So, olive skin. You know. So what's with this, like, silly thing that they have down in Texas? Well, I know the Baptist Republicans, and the Jeff Sessions. They're not white anyway. They're blotchy pink. So that's the thing. No escape. Therefore, make it good. Make it great. Right? Doesn't that become so? That's the reason for emptiness. The emptiness is the solvent, the lubrication that sort of makes you able to face the idea of being stuck forever with everyone, and having to make it the best. You know, everyone wants everyone else to be happy. It's the opposite. The samsara is. Everybody wants something from everybody else and not getting enough. So therefore, everyone's dissatisfied. Right? And afraid someone else is going to come and take their things. And that's like that. And if you think of embodiments, you know, the embodiment of a predator, the embodiment of all kind of crocodiles and things are like all armored, you know, the boundary, that armoring, the scales, you know, the fangs, you know, the whole thing. Human is a soft-skinned thing with crappy little weak fingernails and tiny little teeth, and you know, they're munching some vegetable, and they'll eat a piece of meat if they find it somewhere running after they jump down out of the tree. But the omnivores, but they're feeble people, and they need to interact with each other, and their power comes from their interaction. And the militarist societies that pretend they're a bunch of mighty hunters is a bunch of BS. They were hiding in a cave with that tiger growling outside. Mark, what should we do? And then Nina or Arlene said, hey, guys, here's a little stick I use for cooking. make a big one and go out there and like, cut up to that tiger. Oh, thanks, dear. You go first. You first. I'll follow you. That's the mighty hunter.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa in Phoenicia, New York, August 2017, at the annual Tibet House US Buddhism and Psychotherapy Program. This perennial favorite brings together Dr. Mark Epstein and Professor Robert A.F. Thurman together in an informal dialogue discussing how Buddhism and psychotherapy relate. This year, the program's focus is on addiction, recovery, and anxiety. To learn more about this annual program, be sure to visit menla.us. Also visit the Tibet House US YouTube channel to watch previews from past programs. Full archives from these programs are available in the Tibet House US membership archives. As we heard in the first part of the podcast, Bob and Mark discussed the Heart Sutra, its history, its symbolism, and how it relates to our everyday lives. Second half of this podcast is Bob talking about how we can manage our misery. I really enjoyed the second half of this week's podcast. It was at the end of a session and Bob was on fire. And he wanted to leave a message to the day's participants that they could use in their daily lives. So I hope you enjoy the second part of this week's episode. To learn more about the teachings and work of Dr. Mark Epstein, please visit markepsteinmd.com. Show your support and be sure to follow, like, and subscribe to Dr. Mark and Dr. Bob on all your favorite social media platforms. This free weekly podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special invites to tours around the world with Robert Thurman and geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. And special thanks this week to Omega Institute. Through innovative educational experiences that awaken the best in human spirit, Omega provides hope and healing for individuals and society. To learn more, visit eomega.org or visit their campus in Rhinebeck, New York with Robert Thurman, June 29th, for his program, The Deep Yogas of the Dalai Lama. And the weekly interstitial music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is provided by Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzin Chogyal, visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and Dr. Mark and the second half of this week's episode.
Is not good because it's weak. But reasonable faith, the reason of relativity, faith in relativity, faith in the field of love is good. It's like good old Eric Erickson. He was a teacher of mine as an undergraduate at Harvard. Mm-hmm. his white hair.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite a sweet person. Mm-hmm. But that basic thing was, you know, the first thing for formation of identity was basic trust.
Basic trust, yeah.
You know, that's the key thing in people's lives. And I, at the time, I had some friends who really needed it, were brought up in a certain way. And never mind, that's another story I will tell another time. So that's the thing. And that relates to how I manage my own misery, which I will share with you. My own misery is that in this life, 55 years or whatever of studying these wonderful, wonderful analysts, this wonderful analytic tradition of the wisdom traditions, and seeing it even with the help of the Dalai Lama, my teacher, my original Mongolian teacher, I'm still not in a permanent flow state. I'm still not enlightened. I still can't change the world, at least in a different way. I cannot. And so, but I have a consolation. And my consolation is through reasoning. Given the infinity of continuum energy, conservation of mental energy as well as physical energy, the most subtle type of energy. Mental energy is physical, ultimately. Physical is mental, ultimately. So that's not a problem, ultimately. But relatively, mental is the more subtle physical, super subtle physical. And given the infinity of it, there's no reason to say I won't attain it, nirvana. I won't become aware of the nirvanic nature of reality. I certainly will, because I have infinite time. I can be stupid and dense and stubborn and crazy and self-masochistic, going through these things endlessly. But since it's endless, it's eventually I'll stumble on some way out of it. Poetry will meet me, or whatever, or a kind old mother. I'll know she's around the corner. Actually, I'll never grasp the old mother because I am the old mother.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no one who can grasp it in a way, but I can somehow give myself to it. So I know I will. And then, by studying Buddha's life, there's a logical thing. Just before Buddha became enlightened, he remembered his own infinite past lives. Then, the minute he did that, he also remembered, sitting under that tree, he became aware of everybody else's infinite past lives. And then in Theravada, in the dualistic Buddhism, they don't mention what that would mean. What would it mean if you realized you had been every single thing infinitely in the past, with full detail? And then you would see everyone else, everything they had ever been in full detail. Then you would realize you've been interrelated with all of them infinitely. And that's just the event horizon of a field where you are one with all of the beings in what I call the expensive oneness, where you're one with them and yet they're there themselves, the way they are. And yet you're also them, that which is inconceivable. It's like if you right now, each of us is looking out of our apparatus, out of our ears and eyes, whatever, and suddenly we would be everybody looking out of everybody's eye in the room. What would the field of the room feel like if you were empathetic to everybody in the room and fully aware of everything they were thinking and what they were seeing and how it was from their perspective? It would be inconceivable. And a Buddha is defined as a being that has that for all life, which is you can't wrap your head around it, but that's what they said it was. And he then became aware of the different possible futures of all the beings. And then he saw that the time was only a construct, not just space, but time also. And then he saw that they could take more or less time to reach their own permanent flow state, interwoven with everybody else in that field. And then his compassion made him join infinite other Buddhas, which he was also aware of, who are already optimizing all environments for all sensitive beings. And creating, because they had no power to just blast them into bliss, but they had at least the ability to shape their learning environment, in a sense, you know, to expand their office for the exchange of for the new conversation that gave them a new narrative about themselves, you know, slowly and gradually replacing the old one to make them more viable. right? Mm-hmm. To help them find their own viability, I'll put it that way, right? So, what that means is that I will become enlightened. And when I do, and so will all of you, 100%, even if you don't even have an imagination of what that could be like, given infinite time, you'll be infinite. And when you do, the reason, why don't we remember our even 100,000 or 5,000 or even 20 of our previous lives? Because we suffered in those lives. And because we think we're suffering now. So we, you know, we luckily that's a way of reacting to trauma is dissociate. So we're dissociated from our past biological experience. Not the selfish gene, the selfish us. Running around with Richard Dawkins' selfish genes, but been the selfish us. And we were suffering with that selfishness as we are suffering now. But when we realize that that was illusory, we then realize we were not really suffering even in all those past times. So we can then remember them. So in other words, we revise our experience of the past completely. And we realize what the reality of that time was in the past. That there is no non-flow state, actually, really. It's just it's an ignorance. It's a misconception. It's a misunderstanding. It's a misperception. So that means that we will all enjoy being here at Menla as perfect nirvana later. Retroactively, we will enjoy it. And I will enjoy this lifetime that is nearly over, relatively speaking. Fully, retroactively. Mm. I'll be there with my, I did help my grandfather between 92 and 94. He shifted around. He critiqued his nihilism. And he realized he would be reborn. And he started being so much nicer to my mother and to other people and us. And he supported me being a Buddhist monk. Grandpa did. Sent me to India. And I have a picture of myself as a monk. And I'm pointing out Tibet and the Dharamsala on the map to him. I'm looking like that. And as Uma said, I look like Henry Miller in drag. With my shaved head and my red dress. So that's the thing. We'll all be happy now, later. You get it? That's the consolation. That's how I bear being miserably frustrated. No, I am frustrated. I'm working three jobs. I'm trying to raise funds to make this place really so it'll go on in the future after I croak. If I croak now, it would not. Because my network of connections somehow, there's a little contribution here, a little there, never enough. But, you know, it happens and people come, you know. So I would like to be able to happily croak. You know, when Buddha attained enlightenment, what he said was, supposedly he said, deep peace, luminous, without complication or elaboration, and uncreated, meaning primal, you know, has always been here, has always been the condition of everything. It always has been nirvana. It doesn't start. You know, anything that you make by a relational process will dissolve by a relational process. You know, made of causes, it will have the seeds of its own destruction. So nirvana is just the nature of everything, the way it is. It's uncreated. And then he says, like an elixir of immortality, like an amrta, you know, which means a deathless elixir, is the reality I have experienced, he said. I experience, even present tense. Is the reality I experience. And then he said, whoever I show it to, they will not get it. Actually, if we use get it in that sense, it's much better.
Yeah, they're not getting it. Yeah,
they will not get it. Better I don't say anything and relax here in nature, in the forest. He said that. Which just meant that, you know, he knew that he didn't have power to change other beings. And so no point, type of thing, you know. But as a play, without a big serious point, you know, then he taught for 45 years. But his first thing was saying that. Mm. Whoever I saw, he wasn't a missionary fanatic. Mm-hmm. Because that won't work. And there are people might believe it out of blind faith, but then that's weak, and then they'll believe something else. Mm. So therefore, one of your job from here on as an analyst or a patient or something is to try to realize you are an analyst because you do realize the preciousness of life and all animal life, but especially human life, because the human is at the threshold of being able to understand the ununderstandable, to get the ungettable, to give themselves to the ungettable. The human being is the animal that has somehow circled around and landed by ethical self-transcendence in this extraordinary life form of us, which is of this infinite precious because it's at the door of the infinity. Gods are also like at the door, but then they're lounging there. They're like in a 100-year jacuzzi and like, oh, I don't care about emptiness. I'm not going to analyze anybody. What do I care? Until they die from being a god and then they freak. And if you read your Pali Sutras, when the monks say Buddha's in his little hut and they'll bother him when somebody comes too late to the vihara, to the abode, then the sutra switches to inside Buddha's cabin and poor guy is not sleeping because some old friend of his who died and became a god and is now leaving that realm and falling down and they're scared where they're going. They say, Buddha, what can I do? And he's speaking to them on this subtle plane because he's aware of everything, everyone. So the poor guy never gets a break. He's sitting in his hut, he's analyzing King Bimbisara, who's collapsing there. Saying, yeah, I don't know where I'm going. He says, because I didn't really practice enough in my god time. That's in Pali.
Yep.
Supposed to be the real naturalistic one. We're just there like Stephen Batchelor walking around in the dust and it's just no big deal. And give me a break. It's treason. That stuff. So what you need to do is you need to find your relativity all the time. And when you meditate on it, and the starting of finding your relativity is realizing how precious you are. You know, billionaires, you can't even meet one, usually, unless you knew them beforehand. And somehow they don't have you blocked by their security and their like different weird computer things. But why? Because every minute of their time they think is really precious and valuable. Because if they wasted time and didn't make the right investment or choice, whatever, they might lose 2 billion out of 20. Right? They didn't get in on Bitcoin just right. So they think they're really important because what things are valued by in this stupid country is money. And they have a lot, so then they're very important. Evolutionary money is what you had to get to be human. And therefore, your time is really valuable and precious. Because what you do with your time between now and your death, which just means losing this body, which is a really valuable one because of its intelligence and its vulnerability, etc. What you do between now and then is of immense long-term causal evolutionary value to you and everybody that you interwoven with, not just you. And so wasting it, passing it, you know, we say passing time, you know, waiting for Godot, whatever we're doing, like Mr. Beckett, you know, is really tragic. And so but when you meditate, you don't just, okay, I'm going to have a future life. Maybe I was Cleopatra in the past or Julius Caesar. You don't do that. What you do is you note your thought. That this is like mindfulness. Your stream, your focus is not just the breath. You might start with that. But your focus is the preciousness of your life. And you learn a lot of detail why it's so precious. A biological detail from karma theory you learn. And then when your mind veers off, it will go into the consensual reality that we're brought up in and we live in. And it will say, come on, what's the big deal? Who proves that? What's the evidence? Everybody says MIT, Harvard, Columbia, you know, Oxford, Cambridge. Everybody says when the grown-up modern thing is, scientific thing is, when you die, you're dead, and that's it. And that's in our minds still. Totally. You'll find that there. That's where your mind will veer off. Then you challenge that. Then that's where your curiosity and your doubt should come in. And then you say, okay, who says, who discovered that I'm nothing at death? Or anybody was. Who found that out? And what's their evidence? Who has ever found that? And then you will realize, which it took me 40 years of this debate to really realize, obviously no one ever found that out. There is no evidence for that fact. Not only is there no evidence that a person who dies becomes, their consciousness becomes nothing, but in principle, your common sense can tell you there never will be such evidence because no one ever will discover nothing. Even they have a meditative state of akim jani ayatana, absolute, you know, nothing whatsoever, sort of state of nothing whatsoever. It's just a temporary state. It's made of causes of meditative expertise and concentration, and it comes to an end. The momentum of going in it, then you can't do any more expertise in meditation, so then it wears out. And then suddenly you're back in town, seeking an analyst.
Speaking of?
Time.
Wearing out.
I know. So I'm saying that's what you do. You reflect on that. And all of your problems will be solved when you decide, when you really come to respect yourself at a different level. Because you are every moment of, you know, that people go like Meister Eckhart's reincarnation, Eckhart Tolle, power of now, and everybody gets a buzz by being in the moment. But what is that moment if your underlying feeling is that what you're held by is being nothing? All you have to do is blow your brains out and you're going to be nothing if you want to accelerate the achievement. So that's, but there's no evidence for that. So that would be a blind faith leap. Because why, you would not be nothing. You would be someone with a headache. And your subtle body would be having a dream of a really serious headache. In fact. So when you really realize how precious you are, you will not waste your time. You will select a livelihood and environment that will be very beneficial to yourself and others. You will focus on your, you will go back to your analyst and you will try it out. Whatever it is, even if it irritates you, you will not give in to your addiction. You will not give in to your depression. You will focus your anxiety on why was it that I believed, and so many did, that nothing was going to solve all my problems just by dying. Why? How could I ever have been so stupid? And what kind of stupid culture is this that goes around acting like, well, the worst that can happen is we'll all just be nothing. Even if Kim Jong-un and Fox Head, you know, Fox Fur Head, blow us all up, we'd just all be nothing. So then we won't care. That's the reckless, psychotic cultural behavior that is endangering our planet and ourselves. And how could I have ever been so sewed up in that? You will realize, and you will absolutely not waste your time. Okay? Look, he just turned me off, so that's
no,
the end.
No,
so thank you. No. I know. It is time for a pause and time for departure and time to go back on the highway to the land of misery. But drive carefully because there are degrees. And have a great time and keep Menla in your heart and be happy and be analyzed. And your office isn't even big enough for us all. Actually, I haven't even been properly analyzed. Did you say I was having hearing problems? Did you say you didn't have a conventional because you didn't lie down?
I didn't lie down.
So no. You said that?
I said that.
I heard. I thought I heard you say that. So you mean unless you lie down, you didn't do the real thing?
I was. My therapists were not ordained analysts.
They were up-sitting types.
Yeah, they were.
Up-sitting.
Fringe types, as am I.
You are a beautiful fringe type. You're my favorite fringe type. Thank you, dear. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for tuning in, and if you'd like to reach me, Justin Stone Diaz, I can be found on most social media platforms as Justin Stone and at justin@menla.org. If you're inspired by what you hear here, please be sure to like, subscribe, follow, and post on your favorite social media platform. Your online participation helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dalekh.